This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, helicopter legislation hovers over the heads of pilots all over New York.
And Delta pledges $60 million to Joby for eVTOL advancement.
The EPA shocks no one by saying there's lead in aviation gas.
And the 32nd NOL report is released.
Finally, it's NBAA time. We cover the news.
Ian, are you ready to do some Hangar Talk?
Let's do it, David.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, contact.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulis. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulis.
David, our guests, plural, this week, I'm really excited to bring them on. Just very recently, I talked to the Rutherford family, almost all of them. You remember Zara. We had her on the show. She was an around-the-world flyer, pilot, right?
Yeah, Alyssa Cobb caught up with her when she was, I don't want to say she was marooned in Alaska, but right. She was in Alaska
sure she
for
felt that way.
Quite a while. This is a couple of years ago.
So we haven't talked about this much, but her younger brother, Mac, also flew around the world. Dad is Sam, mom is B. They're all pilots, and I was able to catch up almost with all of them. So we'll have them on a little later, talk about the family dynamic and what it's like as a parent to have your young child fly all around the world by themselves. So I had a great time talking to them. Really, really glad they came on the show.
Well, I can't wait to hear what you guys talked about. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah, so let's jump into the news. Not a whole lot of deep stuff this week, but some kind of top line stuff we want to make sure and cover. The first being that things are run amok in the legislature in New York. There's this new piece of legislation. The only way you can describe it is hostile to helicopter pilots, owners, operators. And that's the point. Basically, what this allows people to do is take matters into their own hands and file lawsuits against operators.
And they could be frivolous lawsuits, Ian, and it doesn't take much to file something underneath this proposition, the Stop the Chop, Senate Bill 7493 Alpha. And it's intended to, there's some noise pollution in New York. I totally get it.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere you go, you hear cars honking, drivers mm-hmm. yelling, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it could be a little unnerving if there's a lot of helicopters flying around. But, the thing is, this could be very frivolous. A citizen could file a complaint against a flight department, a pilot, line service personnel, or the company operating the helicopter. So pretty much it could be a blanket possibility of throwing a damp, blanket over the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's really the point. I mean, they created this essentially to scare people away from the city and from operating helicopters. And there's so many things you can say about this from a sort of a class warfare standpoint to, you mentioned, and I think you're absolutely right. It's like New York is a loud place. It's a loud city.
It is already.
Yeah.
Sure it is.
Okay,
sure
fine.
Is.
There's helicopter noise, but there's a lot of traffic noise and a lot of other noise. One thing that's interesting is the AOPA, we have a story right now detailing the noise complaints. They went from, 10,359 in 2020 to 25,821 in 2021.
Well, that's 2.5 times the amount.
Yeah. The reason being, of course, that people started working from home, right?
Oh, well, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's like, being out of the office. I think first you tolerate more when you're in the office, right?
Yeah.
It's probably louder. Who knows? Maybe where people work is not as close to the helipads. I don't really know. I think when you're at home, right, that stuff might get to you a little more. So to me, this is just a condition of the pandemic. Also, I would be super curious to know how many individual people made complaints, because I know at a lot of airports, you'll get thousands of complaints from one person.
Or from a group, a consortium,
yes,
that has organized itself to be the sounding board, you know.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And you hear from the same people over and over.
Yeah. You can imagine like 1,000 of those 25,000 are from one person, right? So,
yeah. You know what? They're missing the point on a couple of things, though, Ian. Here's the thing. You know, these kind of helicopter operations, and there's sightseeing operations involved, but there's also regular commercial helicopter operations going from point A to point B, getting people to JFK, to LaGuardia, and that's, you know, totally legit. But listen, that brings in a lot of money. It brings in tax revenue. It brings in Jet A fuel for the turbine helicopters. And that is something that I would think that New York could use to, you know, perhaps bolster some of their aviation services.
Yeah.
You know, instead of cutting out the tax revenue that's coming in, you know, cutting that out underneath the feet of the folks who are actually doing a pretty good job of this. So, yeah,
that's right. Yep. Hey, moving on. eVTOL, we like to touch on this every once in a while, and especially when there's a big investment, which there was recently. Delta Airlines has pledged $60 million and an equity stake in probably one of the, what you would call the leader, if not one of the leaders of the eVTOL market, and that's Joby.
Yeah, we want to give props to Avweb, who posted this not long ago. The thing is, I think that this operation is to kind of crank up in New York and Los Angeles, sort of the home to airport transportation sector that eVTOLs might play a role in. So I think looking to the future, that might be the way that eVTOLs, you know, gain a foothold in aviation, you know, being that in-betweener thing. The traffic is horrendous in New York and Los Angeles. We were just talking about that.
I was going to say, I was wondering if I tuned you out. Are you saying that this is to move people from their homes
I think
the cities to the airports, right? To catch a Delta flight?
Yeah, because the story indicates that it's the opportunity to reserve a seat for the seamless zero operating emission short range journeys to and from city airports when booking Delta travel.
So Delta has just invested $60 million in a company that
New Yorkers will sue
out of existence in the first year of operation, right?
I mean, we'll see what happens. Yeah. I mean, you know, but a big air carrier like Delta. Here are a couple of key takeaways. Just thinking off the top of my head. First of all, Delta has a pretty good reservation system right now, mm-hmm. and they know how to make that. They know how to make that infrastructure work. They know how to price the stuff. You know, they know how to move people. So they've already got, you know, ways to move passengers hither and yonder. So it's not a great leap to think that they could just take that down to the micro level,
yeah,
a little bit, if you will.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the way this would have to work is, it's not like they're going to be able to land on every building in the city. So it must be there'd have to be like neighborhood service. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there are so many unused buildings. You know, we were talking about COVID-19 a little while ago in reference to the New York, you know, noise. And I just wonder if maybe some of these buildings that went vacant when people started to work more from home might have parking lots available for this type of intermediate air operation, you know, from a vertical takeoff and landing standpoint, which you could, in fact, infer you could do the same thing with helicopters right now.
Yeah, that's true. Interesting. Okay, so going from electric, which is, of course, going to be battery or hybrid powered, to avgas, our current fuel, and a move that surprised no one that we were expecting. So I think mostly this is about, you know, let's not freak out. The EPA has issued a proposed lead endangerment finding, which essentially means an NPRM that will come out that says lead in aviation fuel is a polluter, and eventually maybe we should get rid of it.
Yeah, and Jim Moore, who wrote this story, says, I love the way he put this sentence in there. This is news to nobody. Certainly not the Eliminate Aviation Gasoline Lead Emissions Group, which is EAGLE, which we've talked, you know, the EAGLE group we've talked about quite a bit. And we expected this. That's why we tried to get ahead of it yet again recently.
Yes.
With EAGLE, which was, I guess, first came together probably about a year ago, unless I'm jumbling up my facts, you know. Now, you know, I want to say it was at the first of this year.
Sounds about really right.
We had a meeting in Washington, D.C. But AOPA has been a part of that initiative to limit or get rid of lead for, we talked about this before, 10, 15, 20 years at least.
That's right.
We knew this was going to happen. So, but you're right. It sets up a process for public comment, which is important. And it also really brings that 2030 deadline into closer focus.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you can see how this issue has kind of shifted over the years by the fact that it's like, okay, we're expecting this, you know, it's fine, it's going to be fine. Mark Baker has this quote in the story, which I think is really important. He said, first, we all want the lead out. Okay, so we're all in agreement there. Second, today's announcement has no impact on the use or sale of 100 low lead, as I've said in the past. So don't freak out. You're still going to have, well, most airports around the country, unfortunately, there are a few in California.
Except for California, right.
Yeah, you'll have avgas. Mark says, as I've said in the past, if this were easy, it would have been done already. And so we'll have Paul Milner, AOPA's consultant expert, on this later in a later show.
Good. I look forward to that. Yes.
Yeah, where he's going to describe the process, and it is difficult. I mean, forget about the technology to make the fuel. Actually getting it to market is a huge challenge. We'll get into that. Anyway, he said, nonetheless, we need a safe and smart transition, and we will continue to focus on our efforts assisting any FAA-approved unleaded fuels, any FAA-approved unleaded fuels, that's important, be realized for pilots as soon as possible.
Yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, we still already, well, we're looking forward to having some more choices. In September, the FAA approved GAMI's G100 UL fuel for pretty much every piston aircraft. And we've had Swift fuels available for quite a while, too. A little bit lower octane on that, the 94-octane aviation fuel that's safe for use in many smaller engines. And Swift fuel's already in use around the country, especially in California, where they've had some bigger problems. So things are moving ahead. Don't forget, you could also do a little search for AOPA's advocacy effort. There's a link, 100-unleaded-avgas is, you know, one of our links there, but 100 low lead is out there, and we have a lot of information on it. Just go to our homepage and click on the top bar, and we'll be right back.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52. All right, David, safety. The NOAA report came out. This is our yearly review of GA accidents and incidents. Well, I should say accidents. I want to make sure I don't say incidents. It's accidents, GA accidents. And continuing on a recent trend, it's all pretty good news.
It is pretty good. Overall, the decrease in total accidents went from 1,167 in 2019 to 1,051 in 2020. So that's a drop. That's pretty good. And then we need to look at the overall per flight hours on that accident rate, too. They also decreased from about 4.87 per 100,000 flight hours down to 4.69. So that's 2 percentage points lower, which is pretty good. And then fatalities also decreased from 0.89 to 0.83. Now, let's keep in mind it takes a couple of years to get the accident report into the NOAA report, and we've heard about a couple of high-profile accidents recently, so that will be in a future NOAA report. You know, we took a little bit of a dive into some of the breakdowns. You know, I'll list one if you want to go with another one, but one thing that to me is a little curious is maneuvering accidents. That's an area that has had high lethality, and that saw a substantial decrease in fatal accidents reaching a 10-year low. So that's pretty good. Maneuvering accidents, that's something that I don't really think about often. I usually think about landing accidents or takeoff accidents.
Yeah, that is good. And of course, maneuvering, a lot of that is FAA has been talking about that for a number of years now. So that's good. You know, the stuff that gets me, I think, is a little bit, I'm always interested in, kind of the bonehead stuff that we continue to do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, fuel management, you can see that's gone down. That's really good.
It has.
Yep. It went down. I can't do the math off the top of my head. Let's call it 10%. It went from 69 accidents in 2019 to 58
in
2020. That is good. One fewer fatality.
Well, maybe we have more tools at our discretion now, too. Don't forget, a lot of the GPSs that we have in our aircraft, you can punch in, you know, how much fuel you have when you fill up and kind of keep an eye on that. Plus, we do have more accurate fuel gauges. The bottom line is that you still need to be looking at your watch and depending on if you got a headwind or not, like Dave Hirschman and I encountered the other day when we were flying back in 182, that will affect your fuel quantity. And
you got to be on it. That's
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing for me is takeoff and landing accidents. I always look at those because, landing accidents are not usually terribly dangerous for us as people, right? I think in 2020, there were two fatalities. And they were both based on runway conditions. Well, I say two fatal accidents, I should say. But tons and tons of total accidents.
Yes,
and it's like
very
if
high.
We could just keep it on the runway and not collapse the gear and everything. It's like the amount of insurance claims and the cost of insurance from takeoff landing accidents is just huge,
it
huge,
is.
Huge.
It's a so you're right. Landing accidents continue to remain the leading type of accidents, but account for the lowest number of fatalities.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's why. I mean, I don't know if it's just because it's more challenging for people. I think it's because people don't like to invest in training, right? So they just go with the CFI every 2 years for their flight review, and then that's it. But really, we should be doing it more often. You should push yourself with the CFI, I think, especially in crosswinds. The other thing is that was a couple of years ago really got me is as I looked at takeoff accidents and stalls in particular, and they are, because we always talk about that base to final turn, but stalls during takeoff is actually a pretty big problem. And you can see here, I mean, it's like 53 accidents from loss of control on takeoff. That's pretty significant, you know, stalled or settled on takeoff. So 36 times that happened in 2020. I mean, that's a lot.
So I was flying with my daughter, Lauren, when she was a very young lady. And we were taking off in the Mooney out of Atlanta at Peachtree DeKalb Airport. And so I can see how a takeoff accident could occur because I said, all right, Lauren, follow through on the yoke for this one. And she pulled that thing back into her gut, and we turned into a rocket ship. It was like virtually straight up in the air. And I said, Lauren, Dad has controls again. And so pushed the nose over. But you know what, Ian? If you're not careful about that, and listen, in all seriousness, in a Cessna 182, in a go-around situation, because you got to trim that pretty much nose high when you're coming in to land. And if you add the power to that, that airplane is going to pitch up pretty severely. You really need to push forward, you know, immediately. So I understand how sometimes that can happen. The RV-12s that we have here on our flight line for training, you know, those are pretty light airplanes, and it's pretty easy to over-rotate something like that, too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, I think, the name of the game on takeoff is, and go around too, it's like, just chill out, man. It's like, the airplane flies really well. Just, you know, put in the power, pay attention, and just chill out. There's no need to haul back really hard. And
yeah. I recently flew with you. I don't know if our listeners realize that, but I came down to visit with you not long ago. We were doing some stories, but you are a very chill pilot. I was impressed, you know. And
it comes, you know what? Once you're an instructor and your student, it, like Lauren, right? Goes, I had a student, it's like, we landed and I thought, oh, this is all good. He's doing great. And all of a sudden, for no reason, we just start. I mean, it's like he made a beeline for a runway light. I mean, just boom, veers off towards the side of the runway. It's like, when that stuff happens to you, after a while, you're just kind of like, it's all good, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you were patient with me when we were flying together. And that's a really neat little airplane. Folks, just to remind folks, you've got a part interest in a Cessna 172 XP. Which is a pretty high performance aircraft, but it's really a lot of fun to fly.
It is fun. Yeah. Yeah, we had a good time. All right, David, NBAA, it's going on just this week, right? As we record this. So, you know, we'd like to always sort of I guess, give the top line of what's going on. And I would say nothing earth-shattering, but lots of little announcements and a big focus on SAF.
Yeah. I think SAF was the talk of the town. You know, Bombardier said that they're going to cover all of its, they already cover all of their flight operations right now with sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF. And they deal with Signature a lot on that, too. I think that's a step in the right direction. They do a lot of their demo flights with SAF.
Yeah.
From an economic standpoint, jet sales have bounced back. Mm-hmm. I think that is something to look at, too. You know, when we look at these figures, the sales figures and deliveries and all, we still got to remember that this is, as we record this, we're in 2022. 2019 was the last, quote unquote, like normal year, you know, a bit of 2020 maybe. But Honeywell, they always have an update on business aviation, and they announced the findings at the NBAA, and there's some pretty high numbers there. They predicted a 10-year global forecast that is 8,500 aircraft. So that's a lot. It counts for, the deliveries counted for $274 billion. Didn't do the math on that. A math ain't great.
That's a lot.
But that's a lot of money for 8,500 business jet deliveries.
It is. So that's their forecast, and they say it's like huge compared to last year, bouncing back a lot faster. They're talking about demand back to 2015 levels. So that's all really good. I mean, really the challenge, I think, is obviously supply chain, which we've talked about. They could, you know, the manufacturers could push more airplanes out the door if they could get the labor and the raw materials.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think it's this really interesting, and this, we saw this, I think, at Oshkosh and Sun and Fun too. The mood, which is important, right? I mean, we sort of, like, I know we always like to talk about it, but it is important because that talks about, you know, people's buying habits and how much they're flying and all that kind of stuff. The mood is good.
It is.
People seem upbeat, and they're talking about these really good indicators, but then there's no huge announcements. And I don't know if that still is down to the supply chain shortages and just not being able to develop new product, or there was like a kind of an investment lull during COVID. I don't know what that's all about exactly, but we're sort of, you know, a little step-by-step kind of stuff with the SAF announcements, which I think are important. And then, you know, it's like, I don't know, the Honda jet had, they talked about a new model. You know, there's just not a lot there.
Just small incremental advances throughout the line, I think it would be the tone of the day.
Yeah.
But as we said right at the beginning, SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, that's key. You know, besides Bombardier, for instance, Embraer's already burning sustainable aviation fuel. And they mm-hmm. say that by 2050, all of its new jets will have zero carbon emissions. Interestingly, for Embraer, and I thought this was kind of cool and different, by 2030, 100% of the electricity Embraer uses will come from renewable sources. By that, I'm guessing solar power, windmills, you know, some of that hybrid battery storage technology. That, to me, is kind of cool. And as we are talking about that, I want to bring this into the equation. Just yesterday, as we record this, President Biden went ahead and threw the gauntlet down for more development for the battery technology. And that could lead to some of these advances, not just SAF, which is fuel, but there might be sort of a hybrid version of some of these business operations that we hadn't really thought about yet.
Yeah. So, David, let's talk about, so we're going all the way from jets back down to little microlights, European microlights, the Shark. The Rutherford kids, Zara and Mac, as we mentioned, both flown around the world successfully. Really young kids. It's an incredible achievement. I know lots of people like to say, oh, we shouldn't be encouraging kids to fly around the world. I say, forget about it. It's like these kids are well-trained.
They come from a pilot family. Their mom's a pilot.
Yes, they have the full support of their family. They're not doing any, you know, they are very experienced before they go. So anyway, I think these are great stories. I love to see this. And I was lucky enough to... Unfortunately, Zara was in class. She's in Stanford, and so we couldn't get her on the call, but we were able to get Sam, Dad, Mom, B, and Mac. Well, so we've got most of the whole Rutherford family here. Sam, B, and Mac, thank you all so much for joining me. I'm really excited to talk to you as a family, especially after all these accomplishments you've had over the past, year or year and a half, 2 years almost. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we're all split up here because Sam and B, you guys are at home in Brussels, and Mac, you're at school in the UK, and we're missing Zara because she's in class over at Stanford. So you guys are all over the globe now, but together now, which I'm really excited about. So I just want to start kind of at the beginning, actually. I want to know when the conversations for these big trips began. I mean, you guys are, or Mac and Zara, you're so young. So obviously, so much planning has to go into this. And so you must have started talking about this incredibly young.
Yes. Yeah, so it was really like not long after my sister started planning her journey and it was starting to become a reality that I started thinking about something similar. And like I had already gotten my license in flying and I wanted to do something with it. I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to do something with it. And this was just like an amazing thing. And I thought, I'll try and do something similar. And so that's how it all began.
So you were, I think, just a little over 15 when you started. For us in the States, the rules are different, obviously. We can't, you know, we can solo at 16 and get a license at 17. But you were a pilot at, 15 and a half or something like that. Is that right?
Yes. So, like, basically, 2 months after I got my, I turned 15, I got my license. So I went especially to France just to take my license because it's the only place in the world where you can get one at 15. And took all the tests. Luckily, I was able to pass, and I was then able to become a pilot.
That's great. So you come from a flying family. Sam and B, you're both pilots. Sam, I think you fly professionally, and B, maybe just for fun. So tell me a little bit about your flying backgrounds.
You go.
I started flying helicopters in the Army, British Army. And part of the training for that, of course, is starting on aeroplanes, small aeroplanes, on chipmunk. And then I did 8 years flying helicopters in the Army and then left. I was being threatened with promotion into a desk job, which didn't fill me with huge amounts of glee or excitement. So I left and have continued to fly since then. Still some rotary, but now mostly small fixed wing.
And B, you fly as well.
Yeah, on my side, I remember flying with my father when I was a young child. And so my father and my grandfather were both recreational pilots. So I think it was a dream that remained at the back of my mind. And at some stage, I must have told Sam because some early Christmas on, he gave me flying lessons as a present. And that's how it all started. So I learned to fly recreationally. And then we did big, long trips together, mainly through Africa and then different things. Wow. And we took the kids in car seats in the plane took them to Mozambique and South Africa and Kenya.
Amazing. So the kids were exposed at a young age then in these long, really some over water, over desolate terrain, that sort of thing. That was almost normal for them growing up, I guess.
I think so, up to a point, yes. Yeah, I mean, so certainly since very young, you know, we tended to go to places using a small plane rather than a car. Mm-hmm. That's actually much more common in the US than it is, frankly, anywhere else in the world. You guys in the US really have got it all sorted out in terms of really using airplanes to do cool and funky stuff and even normal and mundane stuff. But the last few years, we've been living in Brussels. Both the children were at school in England, and to and from school was done with the plane. So they'd be taking 6 or 7 flights back and forth per month. So it really became the family vehicle.
Wow, how about that? So the trips, the around the world trips, you started planning a couple of years ago, I guess, to Sam and B. When did you feel like the kids were ready? I mean, most parents have to deal with, when are they going to let their kids drive? And a few lucky ones get to worry about when are they going to let their kids solo or maybe fly the airplane alone, something like that. But now you're talking about somewhere completely different, far flung. So when did you start to feel okay enough to really dive into the planning?
I think that's very different timings for both of us.
Sure.
I think Sam was pretty ready almost immediately for both Zara and Mac. Yeah. For both, I had a big reluctance. Strangely enough, with Zara, I picked her brain very early on because I wanted to know what her motivation was. She was also the first to talk about this. And I wanted to know absolutely for sure that she really wanted this, because I could foresee very difficult moments. And if she couldn't dig deep, that it was not going to be possible. I also fairly early on realized that she was a legal adult and that I had nothing to say, basically. So I might as well, you know, be supportive rather than be an obstacle if she was going to do it anyway. For Mac, it was a totally different story for me, because Mac very early on said he wanted to go as well while Zara was still in the air. And I did just not even want to think about it. So I was very, very strict and said there was no way I was going to let him go. And the story evolved and Zari kept being in the air. And I said, we can talk perhaps when Zara and if Zara's back. But the trip was delayed a long time. So long,
yeah.
Kept pushing and asking till I snapped and said, no, you're not going. Absolutely not. And then he wrote me a really long letter, because basically my argument was, I am convinced and I know you're an excellent pilot. That is not my worry. My worry is that you're only 16 years old and that I'm afraid that it's going to be a very difficult thing to do considering your age. And he then wrote me an extremely long letter explaining why he was mature enough and why this was the right time for him. And I cried over that letter, because I realized that he was basically telling me that this was his dream and that I might take away an opportunity from him that wouldn't arise anymore. And he was pleading me to let him go. So that was extremely difficult for me as a mother to say yes to that.
Absolutely.
But yeah. I did, about 2-3 weeks down the line. It was his Christmas present last year.
Oh, wow. So, Mac, you, at the risk of breaking your mother's heart, you made this impassioned plea to do this. So why did you feel like it had to be now? Did you feel very strongly that you wanted to break the record and become the youngest, or just that you wanted to do this and you just felt like it was the right time?
Well, it was the perfect time in terms of school. So if I had done it this year, say, I have my A-levels, which are the big end exams in the UK, there was basically no chance of me doing it now. And then life just keeps going. There's only a certain amount of time that you can delay things. There's a certain point where you just have to say, okay, this is what my goal, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to try and strive for it. And that was what I was also trying to show, that you can wait, but sometimes just go for it. Even if you're under 18, even if you're still young, you can follow your dreams and they can come true.
Hmm. So in addition to all of the flight planning, which is obviously a lot of work, I think a lot of people maybe don't realize the amount of work that goes in on the back end, and all the approvals, all the overflight permits and the landing permits and everything else that must happen. And that takes a lot of time. And so to not even really get the go ahead for this until a couple of months before you left, I mean, you had an immense amount of work to do just in that short period.
Yes. So there was a lot of work, and actually my parents were hugely helpful in that, because if I'm somewhere in the Sudan, it's going to be very difficult to actually do anything. And both my parents are very experienced in those types of areas, in both aviation but also in the paperwork side, so they were hugely helpful in that area. And yes, of course it's very difficult, but you have to keep moving forward, keep trying to solve the problems. Much of the paperwork actually has to be done while you're actually on the way. So for example, permits, they can only be done very very near to when you're actually going to enter the country. Yeah. So a lot has to be done on the go, but you just have to try and push forward and keep going.
So how much of Zara's planning were you able to utilize? I mean, I know the route was a little bit different. She took a little bit longer route in some places. You were a little faster. She had some issues in Russia, I know, just with visas and things. And it appears that you skipped that entirely, maybe because of her experience. So how much were you able to transfer over?
There was definitely some, so definitely the experience definitely helped. But actually, I'm pretty sure there were many problems in terms of paperwork for me too. So I was stuck in Crete for a month and a half due to paperwork that had happened with the plane and with Egyptian permits. And then I was stuck in Dubai for another month and a half due to permits again for Iran and places further on. So it wasn't, even on the paperwork side, even with all the experience, there are issues. But you, like I said before, you just have to keep moving forward. Even like there were certain times where it was very difficult to see how I was going to be able to progress. But I just to try and move forward.
I know B said it took a little time for you to become comfortable. Sam, much sooner, much faster. But there's the element, I think, that a lot of people, well, that I would say that surprised me, in that you guys both did this trip completely VFR, in a VFR airplane. And that is an entirely different challenge, I think, than this sort of a trip with an IFR platform and being able to file and go through weather. So I don't know, Sam, was the VFR element, did that give you pause? Did you feel like that was an extra layer of challenge that maybe, you know, it would make more sense to wait for a different platform or for more training or something like that? Or did you feel completely comfortable that VFR was the way to do this?
It wasn't by choice. IFR gives a number of options, which includes, you know, a safer way of doing things. But neither Zara nor Mac had an instrument rating. Hmm. The aircraft we chose to use for a number of different reasons is day VFR, because that's the other thing as well. It's also no night.
Oh, during day, yeah.
Day VFR only. And so that just created a different framework that we had to work within. So it didn't make the journey impossible, clearly, but it definitely made it more difficult, and also was a factor in how long both of their circumnavigations took. And there were a huge number of times when they weren't able to fly, when if they had been in an aircraft or had themselves been capable of flying an IMC and or flying at night, they could have carried on more quickly and more efficiently. So it was a big factor in the planning. But all it did is it was something else that needed to be managed correctly and safely, which is what they both did.
Yeah. So, and speaking of weather, B, I would imagine there are many sleepless nights where you're talking to the kids while they're somewhere halfway around the world. You're talking about the weather. You're worrying about it. And so there's got to be a give and take there between being a mom, being a mentor on the trip, and a support system, and knowing what they're facing. And that had to be really difficult at times.
Yeah, it was very, very difficult. I try to do some of the flight following in the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I understood very early on that was just not what I could take. When I saw Zara doing the first bit of the transatlantic, I remember her turning round at some stage. And I went like, why is she turning round? And then calling Sam and going, she's just turned round and she's over the ocean. And what is going on? And he said, yeah, there's a storm and don't worry, we're working at it. And I went like, right, that's it. I'm not doing the live flight following anymore. I just get my heart can't take it. But many nights, yes, many sleepless nights. Sam was up many, many nights because he was together with Megan. They were doing the flight following. Megan Bowden was also a pilot, and she's been extremely helpful to us. And they were sharing from different places in the world this night shifts, if you want, which is quite hard, because at the same time we were still trying to do or other jobs or other things we had to do.
I was going
to
say, yeah, you can't put your lives completely on hold. Yeah,
yeah, it was an interesting year.
It was very odd. I had jet lag without actually going anywhere.
Because your rhythm was completely messed up. Yeah, didn't matter where you were.
I had no idea what hour or even what day it was at times. It was very, very, some sort of strange blur.
I can imagine.
At times we did join Zara once. Well, we joined her in Mexico when she was to land there, and then stayed longer than she only landed. You know, we only saw her for 48 hours, and then she kept going. But we stayed because it made more sense for us to be in the same end of the world than going back to Europe. And we did the same with Mac when he was to land in Dubai. Again, it just made our lives that slightly bit easier than if we stayed at home.
Sure, sure. So Mac, being a younger sibling, I'm a younger sibling, so I know how this feels. You look up to your older sibling, right? And so you looked up to her trip. Did you feel a sense of pride for her as she was doing this? Or is there a competitiveness between the two of you? Obviously, you've now accomplished this a little bit younger, which, I don't know, how does she feel about that? Do you guys rib each other about it? Or is it all, there's lots of love of the family?
No, it's completely fine. Because, well, first of all, the records are different, even though mm-hmm. I did it younger. She was the youngest woman, I was the youngest person. So sure. They don't really collide with each other. But also, she was hugely instrumental in helping me. I would probably not have gotten the idea of doing something like this if she hadn't gotten the idea first. And so even though I did it younger, there's no competition between us. We're just very supportive of each other.
Oh, that's great. And am I right? I was trying to do the math. Did you guys finish almost within, was it the exact same number of days or within a day of each other? It was very close, wasn't it?
Yes, it was something like 5 months and 1 day and 5 months and 2 days or something like that. Difference.
Yeah, but it's incredible. As if it were planned. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, it wasn't. The long delays, definitely.
I know, yeah, the random delays. Yeah. So now not only were you a little bit younger, but you're also, you know, you did it faster, right? So you can get her with that too. Yeah. So, Mac, you're back at school. Most people on vacation, they might go to the beach or something. You obviously flew around the world. So what do your friends think?
So they've also been like really happy about this. Actually, tomorrow I'm landing on the plane flying pictures before heading back to Belgium. That should be really fun. And it's just been amazing. I've been working really hard at the moment, trying to get all my schoolwork sorted out. But hopefully I should catch up and just be able to carry on with my life and hopefully keep flying.
Yeah, great. And so I was going to ask you, what's next? I mean, you've had this amazing accomplishment very young. Other than finishing school and passing your A-levels and all that, what's after this?
So after this, I definitely think I'm going to go to a university. So I'm looking at university at the moment, but I'm not entirely sure yet. Next is back to flying. In the end, I think that's where I'm going to go into as a job, just flying, but I'm not entirely sure in what area, just that I want to fly in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, good luck, and thank you all so much for the time. I really appreciate it. It's an amazing accomplishment for the family, and I know tough times at time B and Sam, but I think it's an amazing thing, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian.
I think the most amazing thing to me was that Mac didn't even start planning his trip until I think Zara was home or almost home, and he went like 2 months later. So that was amazing. And then also they took almost exactly the same number of days to do it, like within a day of each other.
Well, you know, the other thing is that there you've got to have a little brother and sister rivalry there,
yeah.
You know. So
yeah.
Sister did it first, and hang on, wait a minute, we're not done yet. I remember when the announcement came out that he was going to attempt that, I was thinking, wow, she just finished, you know.
Yeah.
It didn't take long for the family to pick it up and try to crank it out again. And, you know, with like I said, you got to have the support. Even Adrian Eichhorn will tell you, and he's been around the world a couple of times, that it is not just one person. It is a staff.
Alone.
You know, you have to have a support team. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. All right, David, you want to fly around the world someday?
I wouldn't mind it, Ian. I think it would be really interesting. I think it really depends on, I think, a lot of the political climate. And also lately, COVID-19.
Yeah.
But it would be, as a pilot, I would like that. I get into planning the flights that I take. You know, I try to micro plan a little bit, maybe a little too much.
Yeah.
But I think it would be neat. And it would be a combination between that and like hiking the Appalachian Trail, where you ship your packages and food ahead of time,
advance,
you know?
Yeah. So what's they did it what's essentially an ultralight. It's what they call it. I think maybe
a
micro
cool airplane
certification.
Though.
It is very
beautiful
cool.
Airplane.
It is cool. So what would be what's your minimum airplane size to fly around the world?
Oh, I think a two-person airplane would do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'd be okay with that.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But, you know.
It's intense.
You'd rather have a bigger airplane, like a 172 or something like that?
I'd like a little more fuel, I think.
Or like maybe a twin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give me another engine for the for the North Atlantic.
Yeah, I think that would be good going over the ocean, you know, for, you know, 800 miles at a lick.
But I think once you get to a twin, it's like you have to stop promoting yourself, because especially when you get into a turboprop or like a jet, it's like, okay. Yeah, we get it. You know, you can do this. So.
Well, maybe we'll make plans to do it. Maybe we'll do it, you know. Maybe we'll do it together one day. Who knows? Maybe it won't be solo. It'll just be a hangar talk team effort.
There you go. All right. That's all the time we have for this week. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
And I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/podcast and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. We'll see you next time.
All right. See you.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.